Hello, everyone, and welcome to the National Geographic Society program brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. I hope you enjoy the program today. I'll begin with this sports article, A Short History of Tennis Skirts. Controversy over shifting hemlines proves that women in sports have long been scrutinized for what they wear. By Parissa DeJangi. There is perhaps no athletic garment as versatile as the tennis skirt, a breezy thigh-length piece of clothing that allows athletes to leap, lunge, and pivot with ease. They're also a way for tennis players to express themselves through fashion, from Naomi Osaka's tutu skirt to Serena Williams' bodysuit. Yet tennis skirts have had a long and rocky road to the center court of sports fashion. Even as tennis skirts have gained popularity off the court, including Zendaya's use of them on the red carpet to promote her 2024 tennis film Challengers, the controversy over their shifting hemlines proves that women in sports have long been scrutinized for what they wear. Here's how they used and abandoned the iconic skirt to play by their own rules. Origins of the tennis skirt. When Wimbledon's All England Club held its first ladies' championship game in 1884, the two opponents, sisters Maud and Lillian Watson, wore outfits that reflected the fashions of the era. Long skirts, complete with bustles and layers of undergarments. These bulky skirts weren't very player-friendly. Lottie Dodd, who was only 15 when she won the All England Club Championship in 1887, wrote 3 years later, "Ladies' dress is a matter for grave consideration, for how can they ever hope to play a sound game when their dresses impede the free movement of every limb." To break free from the confines of cumbersome tennis skirts, individual players took matters into their own hands. Mae Sutton helped define a new look when she played at Wimbledon in 1905. Her blouse and skirt were looser, giving her a greater range of motion. And most shockingly, her skirt was short enough to expose her ankles. However, officials dinged Sutton for her attire and required her to lower her skirt to what they considered to be an appropriate length before she could resume play. Why tennis skirts became so popular. By the 1910s, most women on the tennis court wore long, broad skirts and blouses that were at least elbow length. French tennis star Suzanne Lenglund wasn't one of them. Instead, she spearheaded a fashion revolution in tennis. Lenglund played in the 1919 Ladies World Championship at Wimbledon, and she did it in an unconventional outfit that shocked the establishment. Her skirt daringly only reached the middle of her calf. Many players embraced calf and knee-length skirts in the next decade. The short pleated skirt is the only one for tennis, wrote American player Helen Wills in her 1928 book, Tennis. It has a classic simplicity, and in action is most comfortable for the player and pleasing to the onlooker. From an artistic standpoint, the pleated skirt possesses grace and beauty in action. How tennis skirts got so short. By the 1930s, new fashions had emerged. American player Helen Jacobs, for example, preferred shorts. She explained to the New York Times that shorts gave her a tremendous advantage on the court, since they are cooler and enable one to get around so much faster. Slacks and shorts attracted the ire of designers like Ted Tinling, a one-time tennis player who lambasted what he called the manly look of the late 30s in women's tennis fashion. Tinling led the charge for the feminization of tennis attire by designing flashy tennis dresses and skirts. Tinling was behind one of the most controversial tennis outfits of the 1940s. American tennis star Gussie Moran shocked Wimbledon in 1949 with her skirt, or rather what was beneath it. Her skirt was short enough to give onlookers glimpses of her lace underwear. Moran later lamented, "I found more attention being focused on my backside than on my backhand." By the end of the 1940s, the typical tennis skirt had a hemline that was about an inch off the ground when kneeling, and those manly uniforms were replaced by shorter and more figure-hugging costumes that accentuated rather than hid the curvaceous female form, wrote historian Robert Lake in A Social History of Tennis in Britain. Why tennis skirts are now popular on and off the court. Shorter tennis skirts, originally meant to allow women greater freedom of movement, have since become a symbol of a particular kind of femininity. During the 2015 Australian Open, one commentator asked Canadian player Eugenie Bouchard to give us a twirl in her pink skirt. Indeed, some critics have derided tennis skirts for being sexist and promoting the male gaze. The revealing cut has also sometimes impeded women on the court, such as one lingerie-like dress that players in 2016 said distracted them and made them feel too exposed. For others, the skirt's femininity is the point. "I think our sport is very tough, aggressive and physical, and women have a feminine side, so it's nice to be able to show that through pretty outfits," player Maria Sharapova told Vanity Fair in 2013. Breezy tennis skirts have become ubiquitous on and off the court. American tennis legend Serena Williams told Marie Claire in 2024, "Tennis style you can wear, and I think we're seeing this more and more nowadays, that you can wear it anywhere. They're just really nice, comfortable dresses." Today, women aren't required to wear tennis skirts during games, just appropriate tennis attire, according to the World Tennis Association. However, players do still have to fight expectations of what is appropriate attire. When Williams played in a 2018 French Open match, she wore a skin-tight bodysuit, which she chose to prevent postpartum blood clots. French Tennis Federation President Bernard Giudicelli derided the outfit, vowing, "It will no longer be accepted. One must respect the game and the place." Giudicelli saw to it that the Federation would ban bodysuits. The tennis skirt's place in the sport and in fashion may be secure, yet over a century since tennis skirts first became a topic of controversy, it seems likely that debates over what women wear on the court will remain as loud as ever. That completes the first article. The title was A Short History of Tennis Skirts by Parissa DeJangi. The title of the next article is Wildfires Are Making Their Way East, Where They Could Be Much Deadlier, by Sarah Novak. When we think of wildfires, we often think of western states, like California, where massive blazes, such as the fires that burned in and around Los Angeles earlier this year. But more than 100 fires recently burned through North and South Carolina, amid dry and windy conditions. While California and other western states face a high wildfire risk, the West is less densely populated, and fires often arise in the wilderness. Not so in the eastern and southern United States, where population density puts more people and property at risk. According to the U.S. Census, 50% of the U.S. population lives in the eastern and southern regions of the country, compared to just 24% in the West. New research shows that there may be cause for concern in the East as well, where fire size, numbers, and total area burned seem to be increasing. Published in Geophysical Research Letters last year, researchers used data collected over a 36-year period to show that large wildfire numbers doubled from 2005 to 2018, compared to the two decades prior. The biggest increases were seen in the southern coastal plains of Florida, portions of coastal Georgia, and South Carolina, where the five largest wildfires occurred. Significant wildfires were also common in the central Appalachian Mountains of Tennessee, West Virginia, and Virginia. Conversely, wildfire numbers decreased in the northeastern U.S. as shifting climatic conditions led to more precipitation. Why fires are increasing? The goal of the study was to identify whether wildfires were growing in frequency and scope, not to show what was causing this increase. But the authors speculate that warmer, drier conditions brought on by a changing climate, combined with a lack of prescribed fires, has led to a proliferation of woodier plants, trees, and shrubs that provide the fuel for fires to burn in greater strength and numbers. This makes for wildfire conditions that are much more difficult for us to suppress, says Victoria Donovan, lead author of the study and an ecologist at the University of Florida's West Florida Research and Education Center in Milton, Florida. Invasive species like congan grass, a perennial weed capable of driving wildfires deeper into the forest, have also taken over large swaths of the South across Alabama, Mississippi, and Florida. The grass increases the instances of wildfires because once ignited, it burns hotter and faster and regrows more rapidly than native grasses. Why wildfires in the East present greater risk? While the fires aren't as large as they are in the West, the risk to humans is much greater. In the East, we have a greater wildlife-urban interface, where we've seen more people intermingling with wildland vegetation, says Donovan. The study points to examples like the 2016 Gatlinburg fire in Tennessee, which, although less than a tenth of the size of the Camp Fire, destroyed nearly 2,500 structures and killed 14 people. When wildfires ignite in densely populated areas, they not only increase the risk of a loss of life, but also become harder to defend. Additionally, the danger of wildfire smoke extends much farther than just the immediate area of the fire and can impact more people in the eastern U.S. Last year's Canadian wildfires, for example, placed more than a third of the U.S. population under air quality advisories. The study also found that 85% of wildfires were caused by humans, a statistic which isn't surprising to Volker Radiloff, a forestry professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, who was not involved in the study. He says that when fires happen in populated areas, the risk of human ignition increases. People can start fires for any number of reasons, and in populated areas, it puts the landscape at risk. They might be burning dead leaves in their backyard, and it gets out of hand, or in the case of the Gatlingburg fire, two teenage boys playing with matches set the land ablaze. In these areas where houses and wildlife vegetation intermingle, it's kind of a double whammy, because when a fire occurs, lots of houses are at risk. You have to evacuate people, and there's also more people to start fires, either intentionally or unintentionally, says Radiloff. Planning for the unknown. While the study did show that the number of wildfires in the past 4 decades have increased, it's challenging to point to trends because in the East, there's still so much variability in the weather from year to year, says Loretta Mickley, a senior climate research fellow at Harvard, who was not involved in the study. There will be one huge fire one year, and then not much in the years to follow. You're left wondering whether it's a bad year or a trend, she says. While in the West, you can see a clear upward trend in fires as precipitation decreases and temperatures increase. In the East, the weather is less predictable. In the El Niño year, for example, the distribution of rainfall in the South and East may quell the risk of wildfires. She says that the study is an important first step in showing us where we need to be taking care to protect the landscape. And no matter whether it's a trend or not, the numbers are concerning. Right now, it's safe to say that in the eastern U.S., there are quite a few ecoregions that have had more fires in the last 5 to 10 years than in the decades before that, says Radiloff. And that ends the article. The title was Wildfires Are Making Their Way East, Where They Could Be Much Deadlier, by Sarah Novak. I'll turn to the animal kingdom for this next article. 10 lizards were smuggled into Cincinnati in a sock. Now there are tens of thousands. Native to Europe, common wall lizards are growing bigger, faster, and more resilient in Ohio. Scientists say the city itself may be driving their evolution. Written by Olivia Young. For more than 70 years, thousands of common wall lizards, known as Lazarus lizards, from Europe have made Cincinnati their home. Even through record low temperatures and snowfall, they've managed to survive and multiply. But how did these Mediterranean reptiles gain such a foothold in a Midwestern city? It all started with a 10-year-old boy and a sock full of lizards. In 1951, George Rao Jr., whose stepfather, Fred Lazarus Jr., founded the retail chain that would later become Macy's, smuggled 10 Italian lizards home from a family trip in Lake Garda and set them loose in his backyard. He had no idea he was unleashing an ecological experiment spanning decades. Today, their descendants number in tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands. Declared permanent residents by the Ohio Division of Wildlife, they scurry across sidewalks, cling to brick walls, and flourish in an environment that seems much different than where they're from. How did Cincinnati become their perfect home? Why Cincinnati is the perfect lizard habitat. Although Cincinnati is not traditionally thought of as lizardy, it has proven to be a haven for the introduced lizards, says Eric Gangloff, a biology professor at Ohio Wesleyan University. He has spent 5 years studying the lizards in Cincinnati, and before that, he researched them in their native European range. In the 1980s, researchers S.E. Hadeen discovered that Cincinnati's climate is remarkably similar to that of Milan, just 30 miles west of Lake Garda, where the lizards originated. Their year-round temperatures vary by only a few degrees Celsius, and precipitation levels stay within the same 10-centimeter range each month. But climate isn't the only reason these reptiles have flourished. Cincinnati's landscape has turned out to be an ideal substitute for their native habitat as well. Cincinnati is extremely hilly, and a lot of the old neighborhoods have stacked rock retaining walls, says Jeffrey Davis, a herpetologist who has been monitoring them since the early 2000s. Many of those walls have no mortar or cement between the rocks, which makes a zillion little nooks and crannies and crevices that the lizards can dart into, and it also gives them access to the underground, where they go in winter, he adds. It probably isn't terribly surprising to biologists that they survived because they were pre-adapted, says Davis. The thing to me that is so surprising is the density of the populations. This species, Podarcus moralis, has also been found in other areas of Ohio and on Vancouver Island, Canada, but no other population is believed to be as prolific. In some neighborhoods, as many as 1,500 lizards pack into a single acre, far more than their typical density in Europe, partially due to the reduced threat of predators and parasites. Even the Torrance Court neighborhood, where Rao Jr. first released them, remains a lizard hotspot. Evolving lizards. After decades in Cincinnati, the lizards may be evolving to better navigate their urban world. Gangloff oversees a team of student researchers dubbed the Lizard League, who study the reptiles in a lab, testing how they respond to different environmental conditions. So far, they've found that the animals are getting larger and developing longer limbs, possibly to help them run from house cats, their primary urban predators. After subjecting the lizards to various temperatures and wind speeds, hypothesizing that they would select cooler temperatures in higher winds to conserve hydration, the lizards did the opposite. And despite prolonged exposure to heavy metals in the city, the lizards seem unaffected. One of our experiments involved running lizards on treadmills to test their endurance and see if the levels of lead in their blood had any effect on this, because we expected that there would be some kind of association there, says Emma Foster, a neuroscience junior at Ohio Wesleyan, and we found that the lizards didn't seem impacted by the lead toxicity at all. Since 2022, this research has been funded by a 4-year grant from the U.S. National Science Foundation, which seeks to identify the reasons that this species has flourished in novel urban environments on a new continent after an introduction of so few animals. The entire population in Ohio is believed to have spawned from just 3 individuals of the original 10. Beyond solving the mystery of Cincinnati's lizard boom, this research could have broader implications, including for human health. While mice are the widely preferred model organisms for biomedical research, Foster says, there is also value in studying unique features of animal brains that are less similar to the human brain. If the lizards are more resilient to heavy metal exposure, then how could that translate into a drug for humans? That's very far in the future, she says. But thinking broadly, that is where this kind of research could go. That completes the article. The title was 10 Lizards Were Smuggled into Cincinnati in a Sock. Now There Are Tens of Thousands, by Olivia Young. And that completes the program for today. This has been the National Geographic Society program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. The articles I've been reading were published in March of 2025 by the Geographic Society. I hope you enjoyed the program. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week, and keep listening to the premium programming offered by Sun Sounds of Arizona on a 24/7 basis. And if you have missed a program you'd like to hear, go to the sunsounds.org net website, click on the broadcast info and audio. On the next page, find the words Demand Podcast. That will bring you to a list of articles available to you. Hopefully, you'll find the one you're looking for. Thank you so much for spending your time with me today.